Bernard Salt. I'm a partner with KPMG based in Melbourne, and my presentation today is looking back and leaping forward. It really looks at the implications of demographic, social, and importantly, generational change in Australia, focusing particularly on what this might mean for our Australian communities. All of this, of course, is leveraged off a popular book that I launched early last year, called The Big Picture. We're the first. $29.95 at all good bookstores. This is actually my second book. My first book was released about 5 years earlier, and at the time, first book, big effort, I was very pleased with myself. I thought I'd jump online to Dimmicks Online, type in my surname as author, and see what sort of company I would be keeping. And to my great horror, I discovered there is another Bernard Salt, this one based in Leeds in the UK. Bernard's published a book called Gardening Under Plastic. Apparently, he has a sequel out called Vegetables, The Practical Guide to Success. And I've gone so far as to actually buy Bernard's book. This is his one sale in Australia. I leave this book lying on my desk in Melbourne. People think I'm an expert in demographics and in gardening. And of course, just inside the front cover, there is a picture of the imposter gardening under plastic in his backyard in Leeds. Actually, that entry under the surname Salt was not of as much concern as the very next entry under the surname Salt. Out of the US comes a Dr. B. William Salt, who's published a book called... and I haven't bought this one. It's published a book called Irritable Bowel Syndrome. Now, I don't know whether you've ever written a book, but it takes every moment of your spare time. You can't go anywhere, you can't do anything. People say, what are you doing? I'm writing a book. What's it called? The Big Shift. I can't get a mental picture of this guy telling his friends and family that the name of his book is called Irritable Bowel Syndrome. And also, despite the same surnames for the authors, let me just reassure you, there is no link between The Big Shift and Irritable Bowel Syndrome. My fundamental proposition to Australian business and to the Australian people is that I think that there are three Australian cultures and consumer preference sets, and that these are underpinned by geographic and demographic concentrations of the Australian people. At the time of Federation, 4 million Australians, just over 2 million, or 52%, lived in rural and regional areas. It's no surprise, therefore, that at that time we had a single bush culture. Cork tats, windmills, shearers and squatters defined who we were as a people 100 years ago. By the end of the 20th century, our number had gone from 4 million to 19.5 million. The number in the bush doubled from 2 million to 4 million, but as a proportion of the national total, it's now less than 20%. What the Australian nation did with the 20th century was to expand into metropolitan suburbia. 12 million Australians in a nation of 20 million now live inside a capital city more than 5 kilometres from the GPO. And this underpinned the rise of our second great Australian culture, the culture of suburbia, the quarter acre block, the three bedroom brick veneer, a culture which was parodied as early as 1956 by Barry Humphries as Edna Everidge, and which continues to be parodied ruthlessly on the ABC by Kath and Kim. But my proposition is during the last quarter of the 20th century, a third concentration of Australians started to emerge on the provincial coast. There are now 3.9 million Australians on the coast outside a capital city, from Cairns to Murrimbula, south coast of Victoria, southwest Cape of Western Australia, and back up to Broome. 3.9 million people on the coast outside a capital city with allegiance to neither city nor bush in a nation of 20 million people is sufficient critical mass to underpin the rise of a separate, distinct and third Australian culture and consumer preference set. It's already having an impact on consumer spending. Out with R.M. Williams, in with Rip Curl, Quicksilver and Billabong as our values, our demographics, our national weighting has shifted from a 19th century focus on the bush to a 20th century focus on the burbs to a 21st century focus on the beach and lifestyle. And you can see evidence of the way in which the Australians are pursuing these fundamental cultures in this ranking of the 10 fastest growing places on the Australian continent for the year ending June 2006. There are 634 local government areas that comprise the Australian continent. The Australian Bureau of Statistics provides population estimates in every one of these places every 12 months. I simply calculate the net growth and rank the results. Heading this list is, of course, the city of the Gold Coast. Almost 14,000 Australians upped and offed to the city of the Gold Coast in a single 12-month period. That's not unusual. It's not even newsworthy because the city of the Gold Coast has held that position as the premier destination for Australians on the move each and every year for 30 consecutive years. Regardless what you might think about the Gold Coast or say about the Gold Coast, I say you cannot deliver that result each and every year for 30 consecutive years unless you reach in and touch a chord with gut, fundamental, middle Australian values. Middle Australia likes the Gold Coast and its copycat and mutant versions that are burgeoning and blossoming, forming and forging this third Australian culture on the edge of the Australian continent. There is a new suburb, a new town, a city as big as Colac in Victoria, just dropped on the Gold Coast every 12 months, forming and requiring the formation of new communities. The balance of the top 10 reflect that second great Australian culture, that of suburbia. Number two on this list is Wanneroo in Perth, the northern edge of the Mitchell Freeway, about 8,000 people per year. Melton and Wyndham are nationally significant. These are two places on the western edge of Melbourne, Werribee and Melton. Both used to add barely 1,500 people per year in the 1990s, and then something happened in 1998 and they started to ratchet up the rankings. It was the Western Ring Road, and it changed the dynamics of the west of Melbourne. And it wasn't 1,500 people pumping into Werribee, it was 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 and 7,000 people per year. Give an Australian half a chance and they'll take the lifestyle option every time. And what you're seeing there is the formation of new communities on the edges of metropolitan Australia and in sea change Australia. This is where Australians want to live. This is, we're expressing with our feet exactly where we want to be. Casey, of course, is southeast of Dandenong, Cranbourne, Pakenham and Berwick. Blacktown in Sydney's west, parts of other parts of Brisbane, Rockingham, which is south of Perth, Ipswich, southwest of Brisbane, and Cairns, of course, in far north Queensland. I've also identified underneath there the leading telecommuting hotspots on the Australian continent. And you can see that they're all sea change and tree change locations. This reflects Australian values. We're pursuing lifestyle and forming communities at a rate of knots on the edges of the continent and on the edges of our larger cities. In the next slide, I want to ask a really big picture question and ask, what has the Australian nation done with the Australian continent in the last quarter of the 20th century? In this map, I've identified areas of extreme population growth and extreme population loss between 1976 and 2006. There are 78 red bits on this map. These are places where there has been population loss of 1% or more each and every year for 30 consecutive years. As a nation, as a generation, we're saying we don't want to live in the red bits, we want to live in the blue bits, and the blue bits are on the coast. These are places where there has been population growth of 3% or more each and every year for 30 consecutive years. This is at the heart of my argument of a fundamental shift in the settlement of the Australian continent and, of course, forming new communities in the sea change areas and, of course, creating stress on those communities left behind in those red bits. The red bits, one farmer buys out the neighbour then moves to the nearest big city or, in fact, to the coast. The blue bits, Leonora, which is a gold mine off a very low base in Western Australia, Narnyat Jaraku, which is an Aboriginal settlement, are simply a change in the way the Indigenous community has arranged their living arrangements. Otherwise, we are singularly, obsessively, uniquely focused on the coast. When you do this analysis for the United States of America, the fastest growing county in the US ain't on the coast, it's not in Florida, it's not in Southern California, it's in the middle of the desert. In the year in which the Gold Coast added a remarkable 14,000 people, the county of Maricopa in Arizona added 137,000 people. If you want to see and measure and benchmark and study a place of rapid formation of communities, then go to Phoenix in Arizona. 137,000 people every 12 months end up in there for lifestyle reasons. The Americans will play golf in the desert. We're different. We don't do desert, we just do beach. And you can see that reflected in this chart. The other change, of course, that has occurred throughout the course of the 20th century is a fundamental shift in life expectancy. And this is illustrated in this chart where I've gone back 80 years to look at life expectancy in Australia in 1928. In 1928, the average Australian lived for 63 years. You qualified for the age pension at 65, so you promptly dropped dead 2 years before you got a pension back in 1920. The other thing to note in 1928 is that you're a child for 14 years and then you're an adult. The life form we now know as the teenager did not exist in 1928. Childhood, adulthood, old age and death. That's the way it worked 80 years ago. And you're an old person at 51 or 52. Tonight, get out your family photograph album. Have a look at pictures of your grandparents at the age of 50. They were old people. They looked old, they dressed old. They knew they had about 10 years to go. Kick it forward. Kick it forward another 40 years to 1968, and life expectancy for the average Australian is now kicked out to 71 years. That is 6 years in retirement that now must be provisioned for. That creates a community. It's called a retirement community. That did not exist in the first part of the 20th century. The other thing that has happened is that baby boomers came along after the war and they invented a transition phase called the teenage phase in life between childhood and adulthood, between 13 and 19. And you're now not an old person until into your 60s. Kick it forward another 40 years to 2008, and life expectancy for the average Australian is now 82 years, 83 for women and 79 for men. That is 17 years in retirement that now must be provisioned for. That underpins the requirement for the formation and servicing and caring of an entirely new community. The other thing that has happened during the 1990s is that Generation X in their 30s came along, they picked up the teenage phase in life. They've picked it up and they've stretched it. I think you are now a teenager between the ages of 13 and 29. All of the traditional measures of the transition into adulthood that baby boomers are making at 21, 22, 23, commitment to marriage, mortgage, children and a career, has been kicked out by Generation X to a 28, 29 or 30. And this, of course, has changed the use of time in the 20-something demographic. You are now no longer committed to marriage, mortgage, children and a career. You are forming, dismantling and reforming relationships, trialling relationships, completing education, travelling. It's a different use of time and discretionary spending that has emerged over the last 10 to 15. Cafes, bars and restaurants have suddenly emerged, and appartmentia in the inner city to accommodate this new demographic. The other thing that has happened, and is happening this decade, is that the baby boomers have picked up the teenage phase in life. They've picked it up and they've reinserted it in the... There's a lot of baby boomers here, I can see. They've reinserted it in the 50-something time in life. In the 50-something time in life as a new sea change, tree change, lifestyle, new teenage portfolio lifestyle stage in the life cycle. That is what sea change and tree change is all about. It's a transition phase between peak income earning capacity in your late 40s and true retirement at 65 and beyond. Whereas once we just saw old age extending beyond 50, we now see a finer granularity. And three distinct sub-markets have now emerged. In the 50-something time in life, there is the sea change, tree change, lifestyle, portfolio lifestyle, new teenage phase in life. At 65 through to 74, you have the traditional retired phase in life, the active retired. This is the grey nomad phase in life, the Winnebago phase in life. And then, of course, beyond 74, you have the frail elderly. Three distinct sub-markets that have now emerged over our time. If you actually stand back and look at the time that you're an adult and that you're out there paying tax over the course of the 20th century, of course it has contracted. You are now no longer committed to marriage, mortgage, children and a career until 30. You can draw down on your superannuation at 55. That gives you 25 years to pay off HECS, to save for a deposit for a house, to raise a family and to provision for 25 years in retirement. That is unsustainable. You cannot do that. As a consequence, I think this decade, baby boomers are going to extend the working life beyond 55, beyond 60, beyond 65. But they'll do it differently. They will blur and blend work with lifestyle, working 5 days, 4 days, 3 days, 2 days, 1 day per week, and they'll put a positive spin on it. This is me doing a sea change, a work-life balance, a tree change. So they'll actually always put a positive spin on whatever it is that they want to do. The other thing that has happened over the course of the this shift, of course, is that one generation in particular has been most profoundly shaped by these changes. And it is, of course, the generation we today call Generation Y. Let's take a closer look at some of the characteristics of today's Generation Y. Generation Y, born over the 15 years to 1991, these are the children of rich, guilty and indulgent baby boomer parents. Guilty because both parents work. Generation Y has only ever known a world of gently ascendant prosperity. The oldest Gen Y kid at 30 was 15 at the time of the last recession. They have no corporate memory of interest rates at 18% or of double-digit unemployment. They think the world's like this all the time. And of course, it makes them absolutely fearless of the future. Why won't the future be just like the past? If I don't like my job, then that's fine, I'll toss it in, I'll head off to London for 6 months, and if that doesn't work out, I'll come back and live with mum and dad. It's a generation underpinned by the prosperity of the times and rich, guilty and indulgent parents. Generation Y is often a single child in a family, whereas baby boomers are one of four, five or six kids. If you ask one of six kids in a family, you are deferential, you are hierarchical. You learn about concepts like waiting your turn and hand-me-down clothes. If you are one child in a family born to rich parents, raised in prosperous times, you wait for nothing. I want it, and I want it now. Game Boys for Christmas in 1993, iPods for Christmas in 2004. A good way of comparing baby boomers with Gen Y is when they first set up households, baby boomers 30 years ago, if they wanted a library, they would build one out of bricks and planks of wood. It was quite the trendy thing to do in about 1978. Whereas Gen Y today, setting up a new household in, say, Docklands or Pyrmont or Ultimo, don't want dirty bricks. So they'll go down to IKEA and buy the entire lot. They wait for nothing. Whereas baby boomers were prepared to invest now for a later reward. Hierarchical, deferential. Another way to think about baby boomers is when they first arrived in the office, say 30 years ago, they arrive in the office and they get into the lift with the CEO and they would wedge themselves into the corner of the lift, avert their eyes and barely squeak out a hello for fear of saying the wrong thing. A Gen Y today, getting into the lift for the first time with the CEO, would say, it's a fantastic opportunity. Hi, my name is such and such. And we'll offer a few tips on how the company should be run as well. Who would you rather have in your organisation? That scared, deferential baby boomer, too scared to even say hello, let alone put their ideas forward, or that gutsy, out there Gen Y who doesn't have a marriage, a mortgage or children or a career on the line. He doesn't care what the CEO thinks about him. And of course, if it doesn't work out, then they'll head off to London. So that's why, and that is why Generation Y is so difficult to manage in the office. And yet, that is why they are so valuable. Not committed to marriage, mortgage, children or career. They live at home with their mum and dad. Free meals, free board, free laundry, free access to the family car. You can have your girlfriend stay in your bedroom overnight. These kids are never leaving home. I actually think Generation Y ultimately will turn out to be the disappointed generation. They have had prosperity in youth, but will they not experience austerity later in life? We've had 16 years of prosperity. Will they get to 40 without there being a recession? Of course there will. We know there is going to be a recession at some point in the next 10, 15 years. And they'll wake up at 40 and find a tightening labour market. They won't know what's hit them. And they'll realise that their youth was more prosperous than their past. Completely the opposite to their frugal grandparents, that generation that touched the Great Depression, that had austerity in youth and prosperity later, shaped their values. They were never comfortable with debt, never consumerist as a consequence. Their grandchildren would be completely the reverse. The other argument is that I think Gen Y has an elastic concept of money. You don't have enough to pay off your mobile phone bill, there's always mum and dad to step to the fore. Whereas baby boomers setting up a household at 18, 19 or 20 were out on their own. Ain't no good coming back to mum and dad. for a handout in 1978. Not that frugal depression generation. It taught you the value of money, taught you how to manage a given set of income for a household. The other thing is that Generation Y is quite tribal, and the argument is that they're trying to recreate the family through their friendship group. And of course, television programs like Friends, Seinfeld, Sex and the City, Secret Life of Us are all programs focused around individuals in their 20s forming, dismantling and reforming relationships, completely different to the projection of, say, the 1970s and the 1960s, Bewitched and Brady Bunch, based around the family, if you like. It's been a switch over that time frame. Gen Y have different concepts of concept of corporate loyalty or loyalty. If I say I've worked for KPMG for 25 years, I see it as a badge of honour, a reflection of my corporate loyalty. If you tell a Gen Y that you've worked for one organisation for 25 years, what sort of a loser are you? You should have worked here for 3 years, there for 4 years, there for 5 years, moving on, gathering experiences and relationships along. This is the new currency. Experiences and relationships is the new currency into which you can connect with Generation Y, that and their friendship group. They will talk about an employment deal, not an employment contract. A deal is a relationship. I'll do something for you, you do something for me. A contract is an old fart baby boomer term about what you will do for me. The other thing is that Gen Y don't have bosses, but they will defer to and take instruction from a mentor. A mentor is someone who is interested in your welfare, your well-being. It's a relationship. A boss, again, is an old fart baby boomer term telling what you will do for me. Nevertheless, Gen Y, highly educated, opportunistic and global in their thinking. Why is it all about the whys at the moment? I actually think there is a demographic logic behind the whys, and it's raised in this next chart where I show the number of people added to the 15 to 64 demographic across Australia for 100 years. 15 to 64 year old people reproduce, they pay tax, they buy stuff. This is the demographic engine that drives the Australian economy and its growth every year for 100 years. And I've superimposed the era in which each of the generations have entered the labour market. The boomers might have been born in the 1950s, but they entered the labour market in the 1970s when the labour market was rising. If that baby boomer did not do exactly as they were asked in 1978, then dump them. Reach into the bucket and get another one until you get exactly the labour market that you want. Gen X entered the labour market in the 1980s when it was plateauing. Gen Y are entering the labour market in a different paradigm altogether. Yes, it is rising, but it is rising at a reducing rate. If that Gen Y does not do exactly as they're asked today, you can't reach into the bucket and get another one because the bucket is shallower. This transfers economic power from the employee to the employer. It underpins the logic of the skills shortage. And if you look at the outlook, this ain't going to get no better for decades to come. As a business, as an organisation, you need to ensure that you are getting the best of the available recruits out there. If you accept that there was a diminution in the birth rate 30 years ago, then that must show up in a diminution in the rate of growth in the labour market and a shallower pool from which you can draw candidates into your business. You think, oh, well, that's easy. All we do is recruit people from overseas, plug the gap through overseas migration. I'm going to show you the same chart for our leading trading partner, Japan. Same chart, same time frame, different scale on the left. The issue in Japan is not that the labour market population is increasing at a reducing rate. The issue in Japan is that from 1994 onwards, the labour market population is contracting. This is the population that pays tax, that reproduces, that buys consumer goods. This aligns precisely with the malaise in the Japanese economy. What prospect do you think we would have of going to Japan and attracting young Gen Ys from there to plug gaps here? Absolutely none. What about the prospect this decade, next decade, of Japanese companies coming here, sitting outside Melbourne University and Sydney University and saying, hi, would you like a 2-year contract in Tokyo? Absolutely. Footloose, fancy free, global in their thinking and supported by their baby boomer parents. Oh, my son's doing really well. He's in London. Oh, my daughter's doing really well. She's in New York. Baby boomers get off on how far out of Australia they've been able to catapult their kids. This plays right into the Australian cultural cringe and the show-off ability of baby boomer parents. And I think it's a very dangerous trend to have something like this. Oh, it's just Japan. Let's have a look at a few other countries. In fact, I've done this for about 40 countries worldwide, and we're actually one of the best. Next. This is China. One child policy, 1979. China is going to be wanting our smart labour in 2016, if not before. Next. This is India. There are a number of things driving India at the moment. Technology, globalisation, whatever. One thing that is not well understood is that we're now at a 100-year peak in the number of people pumping into the tax-paying bracket in India, the consumer bracket, driving the Indian economy. And I actually see this as a major source of skilled migrants into this nation over the next 20 years. India is already number three in terms of skilled migrants or migrants into this nation. It goes UK, New Zealand, India. We only import people from countries that play cricket, apparently. And then finally, next one, US. You can see here the rise of the baby boomers, the echo boom falls away. And then you've got this extraordinary Latino lift. And this is because the Latino, the Hispanic birth rate in the US is three times the white birth rate. And you can actually see this coming through in youth culture at the moment. There's more Hispanic babies born than white babies, and of course altering the cultural mix. And I think this is going to have an impact on popular culture. Less white kids frolicking on the beach in Coca-Cola ads, more hip-hop, street, grunge influences coming out of fashion and music in the west coast of the US. So actually, see, by osmosis, I think that will have an impact on Australia. The next chart actually is quite a little different. Next one. And it shows religious affiliation in Australia over 100 years. There was a census in Australia at the time of Federation, 4 million Australians. And at the time of that census, 99.5% of the Australian population said that they are a Catholic or a Protestant or a Lutheran or a Buddhist or whatever it is. 99.5% of this nation were believers in something 100 years ago. At the census in 2001, believers had conceded or dropped to 80%. 20% of this nation believe in nothing at the moment. And in fact, if you actually take into account adults only, it's about 33%. And if you also take into account people tick the box that say that they're a Catholic but they never go to church, I reckon it's probably down to one in two adults believe in nothing today, whereas 100 years ago we were a nation of believers. Nature abhors a vacuum. If you take away one belief system, another belief system must advance. What belief systems have emerged in Australia over the last 20, 30 years? Hedonism, consumerism, meism, I think are belief systems. People are consumed by it, focus on it, dedicate their lives to it. I think environmentalism is a belief system. Belief system. If you do not repent now, then at a later date there will be an almighty flood. It's quite biblical when you think about it. But again, you think belief systems are shifting and changing in our time, leading to consumerism over the last 20 years or so. Next chart. Now, this chart I've actually looked at the way in which relationships have changed in Australia over the last 30 years, and I've tracked this by looking at the ageing of the average Aussie bride. The average age at first marriage for an Australian woman in 2002 was 29. She was a Generation Xer, born in 1973. In 1971, the average Aussie bride was 21. She was a baby boomer, born in 1950. The average Aussie bride has aged 8 years in the last 30. And if she continues to age at this rate, she'll be pushing 40 by the middle of the century. But it prompts the question of why it is that the average Aussie bride has aged. Is it as a consequence of a value shift? Or is there something more sinister? You think about it. You get married at 21 and you must have taken the first marriageable option out of secondary school. You get married at 28, you get married at 28 or 29, you're doing different things. You're doing different things with your 20s. You are evaluating, you are trialling, you are road testing. You don't need to be in a three-bedroom brick veneer on the edge of town. You need to be in an inner-city apartment where you can form, dismantle and reform relationships before you make your final selection, just on the right side of 30. That's the model for Generation X's, Generation Y's today. You can see that coming out of television. Bridget Jones, Sex and the City. Seinfeld and Friends all show the new protocols, the new arrangement to live your lives in your 20s. But why is it that the average Aussie bride has aged over the last 30 years? Is it as a consequence of a value shift, or is there something far more sinister behind this? And this leads to my concept known as the Great Australian Man Drought. And I am deadly serious about this. I am deadly serious about this. In this chart that I'm about to show you, shows the relationship between the number of men and the number of women in Australia from birth through to the age of 85. And I'm going to start off by showing you figures for 1976. First one. And you can see that 1976, there were 5,000 more boy babies than girl babies in Australia. And this oversupply of men relative to women continued through childhood, teenage years, 20-something, 30-something, 40-something, 50-something, up to 58. Then the higher mortality rate for men kicks in, kills them off, and then there's more women. This is fantastic news for baby boomer women pairing up in the 1970s. There's a smorgasbord of fellas out there to choose from. And of course, baby boomer men intuitively knew that there was an oversupply of men relative to women. They knew they had to commit. So they grabbed the first thing they could, coming down after secondary school, made a commitment to marriage, and drove down the average age at first marriage. This is an issue of demand and supply and the numbers. The real reason is that migrant families tended to send the boys out to the colonies rather than the girls. Kick it forward to 2006. These are the figures for 2006. And you can see that there is still an oversupply of boys at birth through childhood, teenage years, 20-something, up to 25. And then it heads south. Ladies, you have 32 years where you hold the balance of power. And then it flips in favour of men. There is, as a fact, more women than men on the Australian continent now, between 32 and 57, whereas a generation earlier, it was completely the reverse. And of course, this explains why baby boomer women can't understand why their Gen X, Gen Y daughters, go back, cannot find a partner. And of course, Generation X men intuitively know that there's an oversupply of women relative to men. They know they don't have to commit. They can play the field. Now pushes out the average age at first. The reason is the internationalisation of the labour market. Our youngest, our brightest, our most ambitious, our slightly more male occupations are being attracted out of Australia. They're provided with job opportunities overseas, exacerbates the skills shortage, and now upsets the gender balance. But as bad as the man drought is for women aged 32 to 58, it is in fact worst for women born in 1972. There are 157,000 women alive today in Australia who were born in 1972. These poor creatures must pathetically scramble for a partner amongst 154,000 men born in 1972. 157 doesn't go into 154. That creates a deficit or a man drought of 3,000. That is the worst year of the man drought. But it is, in fact, even worse than this, because a 1972-born woman doesn't look for a partner amongst men born in 1972. She looks for a partner amongst men born in 1970. The deficit is not 3,000, it is 13,000 or 10 percentage points. And this is before you weed out the weird or stream out the gay. And it prompts the question, of why it is that women insist on marrying a male 2 years older. That average Aussie bride that was 21, that is now 29, has made very sure that her groom has gone from 23 to 31. And the reason, of course, is evolution. Women have worked out over a million years that the slightly more stable relationship comes from a male that's about 2 years older. Well, that's all well and good, but I say that in times of a man drought, ladies, let go of evolution, look for a partner 2 years younger. So 2 years older, and you'd find a solution to the man drought. If there is a man drought on in Australia at the moment, then women will need some statistical help to find a partner. And for that purpose, I've invented a new statistical technique known as the fella filter. And here's the way it works. You start off with the total available male product in the right age group. You only want young men, 5 years either side of marriageable age. There is 1.4 million men aged 25 to 34 in Australia. That's the total pool from which you select a partner. The first thing you've got to do is filter out all the married men. They're no good to you. 485,000 of those, get rid of them. You've also then got to get rid of all men involved in a de facto relationship. They're no good to you, 185,000. He may not have a ring on his finger, but he is taken, which interestingly is the same term used to describe victims of shark attacks. They too are taken. You then need to filter out all the men at the last census who said they're involved in a gay relationship. They're no good to you. Got to get rid of those. You've also got to get rid of all men who've had children from a previous marriage. They are apparently known as baggage. And then comes the cruelest cut of all. Then comes the most Darwinian of the filters. Out come all men who earn less than $60,000 a year. Keep going. Next one. And you're down to 86,000 men. One male in 20 that survives the unforgiving blade of the fellow. Then you've got to decide whether you like him. Is he too short, too fat, too ugly, whatever it is? I reckon the real odds for women are 1 in 100. The problem for women is they have to work their way through 99 drop kicks in order to find that one. But if there are 86,000 young, single, rich, heterosexual, available young men out there, where are they? I've actually gone into the census to do a special cross-tabulation on these 86,000 young Adonises to find their top 10 occupations. And the leading occupation is accountant. It is a fact. Truth is stranger than fiction. 3,500 of these men are accountants. Now, this either means that accountants are the great undiscovered reserves of rippling Australian manhood, or these are the dregs left over after the good stuff's been snapped up. If you look at the balance of the top 10, you can see a number of computer programmers, so your choices, ladies, are either bean counters or geeks. As bad as the man drought is in Australia, it is in fact even worse than this in New Zealand. Let me show you the same chart for New Zealand. Starting off with 1976, and you can see in New Zealand in 1976, there was an oversupply of men relative to women, and actually got down to an equal number of boys and girls at the age of 30. And of course, New Zealanders have this concept they call their OE, overseas experience, where young Kiwis up and often travel the world and the men just don't go home. And this has led to the evolution of a highly matriarchal society in New Zealand, female Governor General, Chief Justice, Prime Minister. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but you can see the way in which this percolates through and impacts the national culture. Kick it forward to 2006. If you are a 34-year-old heterosexual woman living in New Zealand, you have as much chance of finding a male partner your age as does an 84-year-old woman. And the reason is that 84-year-old men are dead and 34-year-old men are not in New Zealand. They're off. I actually think Australia and New Zealand are small satellites on the edge of the global solar system, where stronger economies are exerting this gravitational force, drawing out our youngest, our brightest, our most ambitious, our slightly more male occupations, exacerbating the skill shortage and now upsetting the gender balance. I think Australia has used New Zealand as a human capital mine for 30 years, and this is the outcome. My concern is, looking at what is happening in Japan and Western Europe and everywhere else, given the values of Gen Y, footloose, fancy free, the predisposition of the baby boomer parents, I think the danger is that Australia could be used as a human capital mine for the Northern Hemisphere economies over the next 20 or 30 years or so. And I think as a consequence, we need to start thinking about defensive migration strategies. That has never occurred to us. We're Australia, we have to knock them back with a stick. But I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case in the early decades of the 21st century. We've already had the globalisation of capital, the globalisation of technology, the globalisation of information. Why not the globalisation of skilled labour? And if there is a globalisation of skilled labour, are we winners or are we losers? Because I would say that New Zealand has lost out in that regard over the last 30 years. Small countries on the edge of nowhere, trading, tithing our best and brightest somewhere else is not really a space that I think Australia want to be. If you think about it, the values of Gen Y, they go to London or New York or whatever, spend 30, 40 years there paying tax somewhere else. The worst case scenario is that they then come back here at 65 and draw down on our healthcare system, having not made a contribution over the last 30 or 40 years or so. The most efficient people in any economy are people that arrive in fully trained at the age of 25, go straight into work and pay tax for 40 years. That is actually what is driving other nations. And I think we really do need to start thinking defensively about this. Next chart. Next one. In the next slide, I've actually looked at household formation or changes in household structure in Australia over the next 30 years. Going back to 1991, and mum, dad and the kids, the traditional nuclear family, was the leading social institution in Australia at that time. 41% of households, mum, dad and the kids. In one decade during the 1990s, mum, dad and the kids conceded 8 percentage points in market share to other life forms. Singles and couples and dinks and gays emerged because of a value shift. I don't want to get married at 21, I want to get married at 29 during the 1990s. But of course, even by 2000, mum, dad and the kids at one household in three was still the leading social institution in Australia. By the end of this decade, mum, dad and the kids will be 28 percentage points. Singles will be 28 percentage points and couples will be 28 percentage points. The singularity, the dominance of mum, dad and the kids as a social institution, that concept of white picket fence Australia, which really did exist statistically for 100 years, ain't no more at the end of this decade, where other life forms, singles and couples, emerge. By the 2020s, in fact, the leading social institution, the most common social institution out in the burbs of Australia, will not be the three-bedroom brick veneer and the traditional nuclear family. It will actually be the single-person household, almost one household in three as a statistical average, let alone hotspots where it's probably one household in two, or in retirement destinations where it could be two out of three type households. And these are not young, sexy, healthy 20-something singles that you see in Pyrmont, Ultimo and Docklands. These are sad, lonely old baby boomers living by themselves because their partner has died off in the 2020s. I think this is going to be one of the greatest social challenges for this nation in the 2020s, where we shift the balance of suburbia from mum, dad and the kids, where you have kids acting as a social glue, bringing people together through sports and school or whatever. What is it going to look like in the 2020s when individuals retreat behind closed door and there is no basis to forming people together as you actually had in suburbia in, say, the 1950s and 1960s? I think that in the 2020s is going to be a major challenge for community organisations throughout Australia. Next slide. This chart actually looks at the number of people added to the 65 plus demographic over 100 years in Australia. Here we are in 2007. We're looking back over the last 30 years of our career, and we have gotten used to around about 60,000 people tipping across the 65 plus bucket every year. And business, as well as community organisations, build their supply networks, their infrastructure, around the expectation that about 60,000 net extra people are going to tip across that 65 line every year. Why not? That's been the case for the last 30, 40 years or so. In 2012, the number of people tipping across the 65 bucket line, drawing down on the age pension, will not be 60,000, it'll be 140,000, and it's going to remain at that level for 15 years. This is the leading edge of a baby boom tsunami crashing ashore into retirement in about 6 years' time. These people are already with us. They were born in 1946. And of course, this is actually going to change attitudes towards retirement. And the next roll. I actually think that people retired today who were born prior to 1940, part of that frugal generation, these are people that are happy in retirement. Modest expectations, modest lifestyles, happy to live on the age pension. Kick it forward to the next generation of retirees. Not only is there a volume shift in their number from there to there, but this is the consumerist generation, the me generation, that boomer generation. No matter how much money they have to retire on, it still ain't gonna be enough for that generation. I think stand by for the grumpy generation in retirement. They're quite agitative, quite political. We shouldn't be spending so much on education or on defence or on infrastructure. That's all for the future. We should be spending more on health, social security, and on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. And X says, hang on, you lot should have provisioned better for retirement in your time, not mine. Because so we've paid taxes all our working life. So you've got the scene set for an intergenerational fight next decade, played out by baby boomers. Next slide. Just a last point about each of the generations, starting off with first baby boomers, born 1946 to 1961. This is the idealistic generation. Idealistic when they were trying to stop the Vietnam War in the late 1960s. Idealistic also when they were disciples of Gordon Gekko in the 1980s. And idealistic this decade in pursuit of sea change. They were famously promoted to positions of authority at a young age where they simply propped in organisations, preventing the rise of talented young exes. They reached their peak income earning capacity over the last 15 years, and they are right now focused on issues around succession planning, and they're trying to weasel their way onto advisory boards and into non-executive directorships. Struck a chord with this market, hasn't it? X's, next one. X's, people now in their 30s, born 1976 to 1976. This is a very cynical generation. They matured to adulthood in the early 1990s in the wake of the post-1980s collapse, made them very cynical. They entered the workforce at the time of economic rationalism as well as a recession, made them very bitter, very cynical as a consequence. They call themselves realists. Get Real, Real Time, Reality TV, Unreal are all constructs of Generation X. They regard themselves as being unfairly held back by old fart baby boomers that have created a logjam in corporations, preventing their rise to positions of authority. The good news for X's is that that logjam will clear at the end of the decade and they will surge forward to assume positions of high office. And it is X's who must deal with boomers in retirement. Then we come to, next, Gen Y. These are the children of the baby boomers, born over the 15 years to 1991. This is the experiential generation. These are the ethicists. They make decisions based on their ethics, their morality, rather than on financial considerations. We're trying to recruit these kids coming out of university at the moment, that is KPMG, and they'll say things like, I'm not going to work for you, KPMG, because you don't have a green office campaign. Or I'm not going to work for you, KPMG, because you audit British Tobacco. They make decisions based on their ethics, their morality, rather than on financial considerations. Mind you, the fact that they live at home with mum and dad enable them to take that position. They are not committed to career, relationships, mortgage or children. They live at home with their parents well into their 20s. As a consequence, they are known as helicopter kids because they continually hover around the family home. Other people call them kippers, K-I-P-P-E-R-S. Kids in parents' pockets eroding retirement savings. They'll reach their peak income earning capacity in the 2020s, technologically savvy and global in their thinking. And I think this is really the generation, that dangerous situation I think we're moving into over the next decade about losing our bright young talent overseas. Finally, you come to the millennial generation. These are the children of Generation X, currently being born today. And I actually think this will be a very conservative generation, quite a throwback, if you like. And that is because this generation of kids being raised by Generation Xer households, Xers are financially strapped households. It's the first generation to actually have to pay back a hex debt during the 1990s, a financial burden right from their 20s that just did not deliver the consumerism into households that baby boomers had. Also, they were leveraged up into the housing market by baby boomers who pushed up property prices in the 1990s. So HECS, high property prices. Also, I think that before millennials reach the labour market at the age of 20, 25, there will be another recession. So they will be more tempered, more straitened by financial circumstances than will be, say, the Generation Y. There's a market, of course, to come up with a cute nickname. Perhaps these could be called small kids in parents' pockets, in which case they'd be known as skippers. Thank you very much.